problem that I want to look at today. I'm going to look at Laplace's equation with zero boundary conditions on a polygonal domain in R2. What can be simpler than this? And I want to look at a competition between standard finite element methods and adaptive finite element methods. So you know, in standard finite element methods, you begin with a triangulation of the domain, and then when you want to have higher resolution, you uniformly refine all triangles in the domain. In contrast, when you go to adaptive methods, you are more selective. You choose only some of the triangles in the initial triangulation, or whatever triangulation you're at in the current iteration, and you only refine some of these triangles. And the question I want to answer, or ask, and hopefully answer, is there any advantage to adaptive methods? So we do this all the time. We utilize adaptive methods. You've seen many, many talks on the subject at this conference. But can we prove? Talking about a mathematical proof now, not some numerical demonstration that adaptive methods help. I want a mathematical proof that adaptivity actually buys you something. There is an advantage to adaptivity. Now at this point, Peter Oswald is not here, so I can pick on him. Usually laughs because of the simplicity of the problem that I'm looking at. But to convince you that this is not completely unreasonable, I mentioned to you that already it did not happen that there was a proof of convergence of adaptive finite element methods in any setting in more than two dimensions until this period of time. In 1998, Dürfer had a paper that proved the convergence of a certain adaptive scheme, and that was followed up with Moore and Nocetto and Ziebert, an adaptive scheme that also they proved converged. So just the establishment of convergence of such an adaptive scheme took roughly 20 years because people had been doing adaptive methods for 20 years. So if you come back to my problem of trying to understand is there an advantage, must be somehow a difficult problem. And convergence of the AFEM doesn't say anything about it having an advantage over standard finite element methods, because they converge also. So in particular, I would say before we started this work, we knew of no adaptive finite element method in two or more space dimensions which was proven to outperform standard finite element methods. Yes?
There is a typo on your transparency. It's written on the bottom that you have 30 transparency altogether, and I find it hard to believe that a seasoned person like you would try to fit you into 45 minutes 30 transparencies. So
well,
it should be probably 14 or 15, right?
No. Sorry, I'll talk fast for you. All right, so actually I want to do more. So, you know, I set out and said, all right, I would like to show that adaptive finite element methods can outperform standard finite element methods, but that's in some sense too modest. I'm going to go further and be a little more ambitious. Namely, I'm going to ask, can I find an adaptive finite element method that I can walk away after I create this method and say, I have the best adaptive finite element method. You're not going to beat me. And I want this in terms of mathematical theorems. So theorems that somehow convince you that I have achieved the best of all adaptive finite element methods. Okay, for those that came in late, by the way, I'll just go back. I'm only going to discuss Laplace's equation, two dimensions on a polygonal domain, using triangulations, adaptive finite element methods. Okay, so let's first talk about what we mean by a solution. So we said that we take the domain and we find a triangulation of the domain, and then we solve the problem on this this discrete problem, this finite problem, relative to this triangulation. What do I mean there? I'm going to take this triangulation. I'm going to look at just piecewise linears on this triangulation. So the trial functions are going to be the piecewise linear functions subordinate to this triangulation. And associated to this, we have the Galerkin solution to the problem, which minimizes So the good thing about the Galerkin solution, it is the best you can do once you fix the partition. It's the best you can do in terms of approximating U from this family of functions, from SP, in the energy norm. And I'm going to measure error here in this talk in the energy norm. Okay? So once we fix the partition, the Galerkin solution is the best choice. So the problem really is a problem of understanding how we should do refinements or what partitions are good. The competition is not over how we do the approximation once we have the partition, but the competition is over what are the good partitions. Well, that's the energy norm. Now let's take a look at what a typical adaptive finite element method looks like for this problem. So what it does is you add a current partition pk, and you're going to advance to a new partition pk plus 1. And this tells you how you're going to do the advancement. So what you do is you compute upk. That's your solution for the current partition. You compute some error indicators for this. These error indicators are that for every cell in the partition, there's an error associated to that cell I denote by E delta. Now, I'm not going to discuss this in detail. This is a big, important subject in adaptive finite element methods, but this is a minor issue for me. But just to indicate to you, the typical way these error estimators look is they look at the solution UPK, and they use the jumps in UPK across the edges of delta together with some idea of how well F is approximated by constants on delta to build this error estimator E delta. So keep that in mind, that there are error indicators. This is a well-studied thing. There are good error indicators. I'm going to use them, but they in and of themselves don't solve the problem I'm interested in. So once we have these local error indicators, how does the adaptive method operate? What it does, it looks at these cells, delta in the current partition PK, and it marks certain of these cells. The ones it marks are the ones where the error indicator is big. And I have to tell you eventually exactly how it does the marking, but that'll come. So it marks some of the cells. It refines those cells that are in PK. And when it does the refinement, it gets a new partition, PK prime. And something bad happens. When you get PK prime, this partition can have hanging nodes. It can have vertices that lie in the middle of an edge without without an edge connecting from an adjacent triangle. So you have these hanging nodes. And so what you do is you need to remove the hanging nodes, because we want conforming partitions. So we want to remove the hanging nodes. So there's a second refinement, set of refinements, I denote by MK prime, which removes the hanging nodes. So that's a typical way. And then after you do that, you get your new partition PK plus 1, and you proceed on. You iterate this. Okay? So that's the form of a typical adaptive finite element method. Now I'm saying I'm looking for this greatest adaptive finite element method, right? So I have to describe to you, we have to have an understanding, what will I mean by having the best adaptive finite element method? That's what this part of the talk is about. So the first thing I have to do is tell you how I'm going to measure the error. Of course, you could potentially measure the error in many different spaces. I mean, in ALP2, ALP, all that. But what's the simplest for us is to measure the error in the energy norm. And that's what I'm going to do in this talk. So this is, I'm going to use the energy norm to measure error. The next thing is how to measure complexity. Well, I'm going to shoot for the best of all worlds. I'm going to measure complexity by the number of computations. So the game I'm trying to play is to say, I'm looking at adaptive element methods, I'm measuring error in this sense, and I'd like a method that gives me the smallest error, or a fixed error. Let's say we fix an epsilon, we want an error less than epsilon. We fix that, and we'd like to accomplish that in the smallest number of computations. That would be our game. Okay, so I want to specify this a little more precisely. So first, I already mentioned that we have to be a little careful about the partitions that we're going to allow. So we're going to take these triangulations and we're going to subdivide triangles. When I do the subdivision of triangles, I have to put some restrictions on how I do the subdivision. And in a minimum, I would like to have that the partitions that arise at any time in my algorithm satisfy a minimal angle condition. That is, there's some angle alpha in every partition that I ever see. Any of the angles in the triangles are bigger than alpha. Okay, so it's minimum for all the partitions that occur. Not just each partition, of course, has a minimum angle, but we want it for all partitions. Now, this would be good if I stated the problem in this sense and then said, okay, that's my restriction. I look at all finite element methods, adaptive methods. They give me partitions which have this minimum angle condition and no hanging nodes, and put that as my competition. I claim I can almost solve this problem. But I'm not going to describe that solution. I'm going to do something a little simpler, and I'll explain why in a minute. What am I going to do simpler? Well, you see, the problem in trying to handle this general situation is that you're given a triangle, and you can have a million ways you can subdivide the triangle. You know, you're not specifying how you're going to do the subdivision. So I have too much flexibility there in some sense. And if I try to describe this, and it'll just get too complicated, at least notationally even, to say, I can be dividing a triangle into 100 triangles, two triangles, whatever. So rather than do that, I'm going to fix the method that I use to subdivide the triangles. And the method I'm going to use is Newell's vertex bisection, which is an interesting, by the way, way of refining triangles that I wasn't aware of before we started this work. And it has a lot of nice features that I think can be utilized in other areas. So here's a description of Newell's vertex bisection. So you have your current triangulation, and this big triangle here in black is one of your current triangles, and I need to describe how I'm going to subdivide this triangle. So associated to this triangle will be one vertex, which is called the Newell's vertex for that triangle. I need to describe how we do this. But what I want to tell you is, if I have a partition, and if I have that every triangle has a Newell's vertex associated to it already, then when I do the subdivision, I'll tell you what the Newell's vertex is for the new triangles. That's what this slide says. So if you have a Newell's vertex assigned to the big triangle, the way you do the subdivision is that you bisect the side opposite the Newell's vertex. This divides the big triangle into two small black triangles. With these two small black triangles, the newest vertex is, by definition, this red vertex that was just added. Right? That's why it has the word newest vertex. So this red vertex is the newest vertex for this left black triangle and also for the right black triangle. Okay? So that tells you how you advance to get the newest vertex for the next triangles. And of course, if you decided to subdivide these black ones, then this is the way you would subdivide it, with the red subdivision. Okay? So that's the newest vertex bisection. Now, this has a tree structure, and this is important. This gives you a binary tree when you do this. For example, if this is your initial triangulation, here's the triangle in there, and suppose you can associate that triangle to a node, a vertex, in a tree. This would be the base vertices. And if you subdivide, let's say I decide to subdivide this triangle, the big reddish triangle, and the big yellow triangle, what you would do is you'd be adding two nodes to the graph, to the tree, right? Corresponding to the two children of this yellow triangle and the two children of the red triangle after you've done the subdivision. Okay? If you went further and you subdivided, in this case, this red and this yellow were, this yellow, the big yellow was that vertex up here, and then I subdivided and got his two children, and I subdivided one of the children. Well, I think you all see this. It's just like when you're taking dyadic intervals, right, and you subdivide, you get two children. It's the same thing that's going on here. Okay, but that's important that you have this tree structure. Now, I haven't described to you yet completely what Newell's vertex bisection is, because I haven't told you how you initially label the vertices. So you have the first triangulation, and I need to tell you what the newest vertex is for the initial triangulation. I haven't done that. I've told you once you have that, how to proceed from then on. But I haven't told you the first one. So the first one You could say, well, what I do is I just, in an arbitrary way, take every triangle and associate each triangle with Lewis vertex. This wouldn't be good. We could not do an analysis in this case. We want to be more specific. And what we want to do, the way we look at it, is the following. We're going to take every edge in this triangle, we're going to label it with a 1 or a 0. We're going to label it in such a way that on any given triangle, like this one, two of the edges are labeled with 1, and one of the edges is labeled with 0. So we need such an initial labeling. Every edge is labeled with a 0 and 1, and every triangle has exactly one edge labeled 0 and two edges labeled 1. If we have such an initial triangulation or a labeling, then the newest vertex associated, let's say, with this triangle is the vertex opposite the edge labeled 0. Okay? That's the way we're going to start. So there's already a question. Can you do this? Can you take any triangulation and label it with ones and zeros in this fashion? And this turns out not to be completely trivial. But you can do it. And this is related to bicubic graphs, and there's a theorem in combinatorics that tells you can do this labeling, and then you can set about saying, well, can I give a practical way of doing the labeling given any triangulation? And the answer is probably you can, but we don't have a real good way of doing a practical labeling that's robust in the sense that no matter what partition, we're sure that it's going to work. But if I wrote any partition on the board, I could in 2 seconds give you the labeling. Not that it's hard to do, it's hard to prove that any particular algorithm will do the labeling in the right way. So back to this one, if you think about what are the newest vertices with these triangles, they're indicated by these arrows. So, for example, for this triangle here, that's the newest vertex, and if you go back, you see that was where the side opposite was labeled 0, right? Okay, so you have the newest vertex bisection. So that's the way I'm going to subdivide. Wherever I see a triangle and I decide to refine it, I'm going to do newest vertex bisection. All right, now let's go to our game. Let's see if we can describe precisely the game we want to play. So, let's let n of p be the number of subdivisions used to create p. So n of p is actually related to the number of triangles, right? Because the number of triangles in a partition will be n of p plus the number initially. Right, so n of p is the complexity of this partition. It's the number of triangles roughly in the partition. It's the same as the number of subdivisions used to create the partition. It's the number of new nodes that were added to the tree. Right? I look now at the following competition. I say, let's look at all possible ways I could. So starting with my initial partition, I can subdivide n times in many, many ways. Let's look at all the ways we could do this, and let's let Pn be all partitions that could be obtained with n subdivisions. And now I look for what's the best, the smallest error I can achieve in the approximation of u by the Galerkin solution on such partitions, and I take the infimum over all such partitions. So I'm looking for the best partition here. Sigma n of u measures the error for the best partition. Now that's a big problem, right, looking at all these partitions. There's exponential number of partitions. We've got to avoid this. We can't do this if we're going to try to control the number of computations. But this is somehow a quantitative quantity that tells you how well you can do. So if you could have God supervise your algorithm to tell you, look, this is what you should do. Take this partition. This is the error you would achieve. Unfortunately, none of us are God. Some of us are pretty close, but none of us are God. So we could ask for a numerical algorithm to perform like sigma n u. So if I created a numerical algorithm, and if I showed you that for every n it gave me sigma n u, you would be amazed, right? You would say, my God, this guy is good. But I'm not that good. Maybe Wolfgang is. So you can't do that. You could ask for a little less, you could ask for maybe to perform like a constant times sigma nu, but I'm going to even go a little weaker than that. What I'm going to ask for is the following, and this we've seen this kind of approximation classes appear already in many talks. So I'm going to ask for the following. I look at the set of functions u, so AS is a set of all functions u, for which sigma n behaves like n to the minus s. So these are, so what I do is I take all the functions u that could arise as solutions for different right-hand sides. And I put them in classes. I sort of stratify this whole set. I put them in a class AS if this behaves like n to the minus s. So the bigger s, the nicer the function. And what I want to ask for now, instead of this performance like sigma and mu, I want to ask that, I have something here before that. This is a new thing that I've added. See, there is a little change in the talk from last time. You could describe this class AS in another way. Another way would be to say, suppose you have a target accuracy epsilon that you want to achieve, then the class AS are those functions such that you can achieve this target accuracy using at most, oh, this should be epsilon to minus 1 over S. That's a typo. I don't know why it's 2, but it should be epsilon to the minus 1 over S. So another way to describe AS is to say all functions u that you achieve target accuracy epsilon with this number of triangles. Okay, that's just rephrasing this. Okay. And I see something maybe got cut off. So what I'm going to ask for in my numerical algorithm is I'm going to ask that the numerical algorithm work for all functions u. For any function u, it converges. But in addition, that if I take u in this class AS, that it performs like m n to the minus s. It performs like the rate that is inherent for that class. So that's my goal. And if I can achieve that goal, I'm going to feel great that I've got an algorithm that's as good as any that people are going to construct. Okay.
But the constant depends on u, right?
Yeah, the constant.
You do not inflate the constant proportional to the other constant.
Okay, so what when we're done, you see this m here that appears here. This, given this class AS, you can define a norm on AS as the smallest m for which this inequality holds for all n. And what we're going to do is show that our algorithm performs like the error is less than a constant times m times n to the minus s with an absolute constant, c. Or maybe c depends on s, but certainly doesn't depend on u. Okay? I think that answers your question. All right. So what I want to tell you about is an algorithm that we created and discussed this algorithm. And here's what the algorithm is going to do. So this is our adaptive algorithm. And I'm going to tell you what it looks like in a minute, but I first want to tell you its properties. So the adaptive algorithm does the following. For each epsilon, the algorithm, so no matter what u is, take any problem, and take any epsilon, the algorithm will produce a partition p epsilon and such that this error estimate holds. So that first guarantees convergence, right? Because you can make epsilon as small as you wish. The second thing is, given any u and as, that the number of elements in the partition is less than a constant. This is this fixed constant c naught that Amos was asking about. The norm of u and as, which I told you what it was, as smallest m, epsilon to the minus 1 over s. So it performs at the right rate. The number of triangles it uses is like n, the right n, right? Moreover, I'm going to show you that you can do this in such a way that the number of computations used to create p epsilon and create u p epsilon and all that, the number of computations is bounded by this quantity. So it's not only that the number of triangles satisfies this, but the number of computations used in the algorithm satisfies this. Okay. I'm going to achieve this, and I'm going to tell you how to do this in just the rest of the talk. But I want to point out a corollary to this, and that is that once you have this in hand, you can now give examples of functions. I'm not going to give one just a typical function which has a singularity, let's say at a point, or even singularities due to the corners and the boundary. You can create a lot of functions which you can then show that this adaptive method will beat the standard finite element method for that. That is the S that you achieve, the rate of convergence, the S, n to the minus S for n computations, the S will be much larger for the adaptive finite element method than it is for standard finite element method. But that isn't the subject of the talk today. So now I want to discuss how do we do this, what does this adaptive finite element method look like? Okay, I've told you it's got these wonderful properties. How do we do this? So why don't we go back to what people do currently and then show that's the launching pad for what we're going to do, and I'll show you what we have to do different to achieve this super theorem. So the typical way, we already mentioned that how a typical adaptive finite element method works, and one of the critical elements in that description was how you do the marking. How do you mark the cells? So this transparency is to tell you how you mark cells. So we said that you take certain error indicators. I described a little bit what those error indicators look like. So suppose I'm now on a given partition and I have these error indicators. How do I choose this set MK? Well, what they do is something called bulk chasing. They look at all the cells in MK, and they take, or in PK, and they take a subset of this. MK is a subset of PK. Some collection of triangles in PK. Enough of them so that you capture half of the sum of the local errors. So the sum over the MK, the E delta over MK, is half of the total sum. So you understand that you take the biggest ones, right? How many biggest ones do you have to pick? Maybe one of them already, just one triangle was half of the error, total error, some of the errors, then you'd only have to pick one triangle. Now, Amos always likes to point out at this point, well, I could take all of them. Yes, you could take all of the triangles in PK, and definitely you would have this. You'd have it not only with a half, but with it with one. And our algorithm would work with that choice. But numerically, one would say this is not a very efficient way to proceed. So I've taken away one of your questions, Amos. Sorry. Okay. Now, we're going to utilize this bulk chasing. So we don't want to reinvent the wheel. I want to go back. So people working in adaptive methods have done a lot of analysis, and I want to utilize some of their analysis. And here's the theorem I want to utilize. So this is a theorem by Morin, Nocetto, and Ziebert. And what does this theorem say? It says, okay, so there's going to be some number lambda, and this lambda is going to be a number that you're going to guarantee an error reduction. So the whole point is here, we want to show that with this choice of marking that we actually reduce the error when we recompute on the new partition. So remember, we take the partition, we refine, we remove hanging nodes, we get a new partition, we're going to compute the error on the new partition. I'd like to know that error is smaller than the original error. And I have to tell you that for years this wasn't known. I mean, you had all these local, a posteriori error estimators and people proving theorems, but they never proved that the error was reduced. You could say what the error is, but you didn't guarantee that doing this refinement reduced the error. So this was an achievement. And here's what it says. It says, suppose you have a target accuracy in mind. Then either, and then you need to, and your current partition PK resolves F to an accuracy like epsilon. I mean, there's some constant here, gamma. It's a fixed constant. So F, you know, is the right-hand side. It's known to you. So that you can, you're given a partition, if it doesn't achieve this accuracy, you can refine that partition and then achieve that accuracy with no problem, because that function F is known to you. So suppose you have PK that does that. Then one of two things happens when you do this bulk chasing. Either the error on the new partition you create already achieves the accuracy epsilon, or the worst, or at least at a minimum, the error on the new partition is less than this constant lambda times the error on the old partition. So you've actually reduced the error. You've either met your error criteria or you've reduced the error. And we're going to utilize that result in our algorithm. So now let's describe what our algorithm looks like. I want to give you first the broad description of the algorithm, and then I'll get a little bit into the details.
The F is resolved in L2 or H-1?
H-1. The error norm.
F is
resolved. Yeah, this is a good, very good point. The right way to do this theory would be to start with F and H-1 and resolve F and H-1. But, you know, from a practical point of view, if you have something in H-1, what is that? I mean, how do you compute anything for it? So in reality, they take F and L2. But the norm they use to do the resolution mimics H-1. It's some quantity that has L2 norms in it, but it has, you understand that now. But that's a very good question. surprised me that you could ask such a question.
The only thing I can do.
Okay, so I'm going to describe to you how you can go, how our algorithm goes from the current partition to the next partition. Okay? So here's what we're going to do to go from pk to pk plus 1. First thing we're going to do, we're going to have sort of an inner loop. First an inner loop, and then we're going to do something else. So in our inner loop, we're going to start with pk sub 0 to be just our partition pk. And then we're going to advance to new partitions, pk1, pk2, pk, you know, and so up to pkk. We go from pkj minus 1 to pkj is we use it more in Machado-Ziebert bulk chasing. So here we use bulk chasing. To go from here to here, we use bulk chasing for each j, j equal 1 to k. What is capital K? Some fixed number, 10. It's a number that depends on constants that occur in norm equivalences and all the like. So some fixed constant. We do this, and why do we do this inner loop? What we want to do is we want to drive down the error. So more in Machado-Ziebert would drive the error down by a factor lambda, one iteration. If we do several iterations, we drive the error down by lambda to the power k. So I can make this constant lambda to the k small. I need it to be controlled in some small number, but fits. Depending on all our constants that appear in the analysis. So we do this k times. So up to this point, we haven't done anything different than the bulk chasing, but done it several times. But now we have this critical thing that we do a coarsening step. So this third step here is what's different from the other algorithms. Namely, we look at the pkk, which is what the more in the Machado-Ziebert or the old adaptive algorithms would have, and we do some cleaning up. We say, let's look at this partition. Maybe we've done a lot of refinements we didn't need. In your terminology, all this noise and you threshold and throw away things. That's what we're doing. We're looking in here and saying, some things we shouldn't have done, we're going to throw them away. We're going to eliminate. That's this coarsening step. Now, to make it precise, how do you do the coarsening analytically? That has to be done. And we're going to discuss that a little bit. So that's the distinction in the algorithm. This is the main distinction. Okay? Now, to prove this theorem, so given that now we have this algorithmic structure, to prove this theorem, there are two main results that you have to prove. And I mean, there's a lot of little details. I tell you, this paper drove us crazy. You know, it's like trying to put 50 pounds of you-know-what in a 40-pound bag. Every time we did something here, we changed something there. But finally, we got it all together. But there are two main elements that need to be addressed in this analysis. The one is, when you remove hanging nodes, you're inflating, so you want it to refine certain triangles. But then you're forced to do other refinements to remove hanging nodes. Those you didn't want to do. And you have to be sure, well, you want to remove the hanging nodes, but you didn't label these triangles initially as bad guys to be refined. But you have to refine them to remove the hanging nodes. And you need to see that this number of subdivisions doesn't severely change the total number of triangles. So this is a main issue. Surprisingly not well studied in the finite element literature. We were sort of surprised that they didn't do such an analysis. Oh. Okay. I see. For some reason, maybe I have to point at that. Yeah. Sorry.
Okay, the other main issue is how to do the coarsening. We've already mentioned that coarsening is a key element in our algorithm, and the question is how can we do the coarsening in a numerical way and prove the theorems you need about coarsening, what it does, and so forth. So these are the two main issues, and that's what I'm going to concentrate on in the remainder of the talk. Yeah?
If you accept my modification to your algorithm and you refine all the triangles that you don't have hanging nodes, and therefore, you do not need to count inflation in the hanging nodes.
No.
The removal of the hanging
nodes. No, what happens if you do your thing, when you do the coarsening, you introduce hanging nodes. And so you have to. So the coarsening will reduce the hanging nodes. Because even though you want to do everything, but when we come to coarsening, we have to go back to the root and do the subdivisions, and then we get a partition that has hanging nodes, and we have to remove them. So we have to address that, yeah. Would be good if we didn't, but
Okay, so now I'm going to talk to you about how removing of hanging nodes. So let's suppose that we have a sequence of subdivisions. So we started with some partition P0, we did some refinements to get P1, did some refinements to get Pn, and how we got, remember, Pk to Pk plus 1 is we had some cells that we wanted to refine, those that were marked, and we had some cells that we were forced to refine to remove hanging nodes, that's Mk prime. What I want to do is get to show that the Mk primes that I've introduced, the number of cells here, can be controlled some sense by the number Mk. Here's a theorem that we're going to prove, that the number of cells in a final partition going from P0 to Pn, so the number of cells here is roughly the total number, it's the number that were marked here, number that were marked here, added to the number in P0. So we're going to prove that the total number of cells in Pn is less than or equal to the number in P0, of course, P0 is there, can't get rid of that, plus a constant times the number that were marked. Now notice this is the number that were marked, this are the MKs, not the MK primes. So, you know, the best you could have hoped for is to put C equal 1 here, because you got to have at least that number of cells, because this is the number of cells you would get if you just subdivided those that were marked. And what we're saying is, okay, the inflation is not too bad, it just changes this number to a constant times this number. All right? So that's the key result. And I want to stress the one point, that this is not a simple theorem. If you look back, you might say, oh, I'll prove this. What I'll do is I'll show that Mk prime, the number of cells in Mk prime, is less than a constant times the number of cells in Mk. You prove this. This is not true. It's not true. You may refine one cell at a given stage, and you get a million new cells. And I'm going to give you and show you why that is the case in a little bit. So actually, to prove this theorem, it's not so simple like this, but you have to look at the entire history at how a cell is created. And I want to describe this a little bit, what's going on, why this is a somewhat difficult theorem. So I'm going to look at a sequence of subdivisions. Let's suppose I started with my initial partition, and I took this big cell, the big black cell, and I decided to mark it. After I marked it, I would have subdivided the cell and got these two cells here. And to remove the hanging node, I'd have to refine those two, right? So there, at this first stage, it doesn't cost me much. I wanted to refine this cell. I'm forced to refine that cell. So this is M1. This is M1 prime. They each consist of one cell, okay? But now let's say I go here and I say I want to mark, let's say, this cell. I think that's the one I'm going to mark in the next picture. This small cell here, all right? At the next iteration of the algorithm, yeah? I refine that. Here it is. I refine it. And now I start saying, well, now I've got to remove hanging nodes. What do I have to do? And you start looking. You have to put in this edge to remove hanging nodes. But that edge, excuse me, so to get to remove this hanging node here, you have to subdivide this cell, but that's what this subdivision will do, this side marked with 2. And then further, you have to go here, and then that'll remove the hanging nodes, and that forces you to do some subdivision here. So you see that just to refine this cell, you've added a lot of cells. And if you iterate this, what will happen is that to refine one cell, you may have to refine n new cells, where n can be arbitrarily large. So at first, when we gave this result, the finite element, people were a little skeptical because they knew this. You refine one cell, but to do the completion or the removal of hanging nodes, you have to do a lot. So I see now with the time allotted that I'll basically only be able to talk about this aspect of this, so the removal of hanging nodes. Okay, so I want to tell you a little bit how you prove this. Result. I'm not going to get too deeply into the proof, but I like to think about this proof, in a monetary way, because it motivates people, right, to start talking about money. So here's the way I can think about proving this theorem. I give every cell in MK. These are the guys that the number of subdivisions and the number of triangles that I'm content with, that I had to have. The number in M. So I'm going to give you each guy in M, this union of the MK, $1 to spend. So the total number of dollars that I give to them is the cardinality of M. And I ask them to spend the money. I asked them to find a good way to spend the money, and the way they're going to spend the money is each guy in M is going to give each guy in the final partition PM some money. Maybe he gives it nothing, but okay, it's going to give money. So the number of dollars that the cell delta in M gives to the cell delta prime in PN is this lambda. And what I'd like to have happen when I'm done is that the, I guess I don't state it here. What I'd like to have happen when I'm done, when each guy in M spends its money, that each guy, turn off all cell phones. Oh, this is, I get it.
Somebody's
going
for money.
So I want to do this in such a way that each cell in PN, when it looks at the total money that it gets, that it got at least a fraction, fixed, let's say 50 cents. Suppose I know that each cell received at least 50 cents. Then I would know that the number of cells in PN is no more than twice the number of cells in M. Because each cell had only a dollar to spend. When it was done, every guy got 50 cents. When it got half of a dollar, there couldn't have been more than twice as many cells in PN that there was in M, right? That's what I'd like to do. And I have, in fact, some explicit formula that will tell you how to spend the money. But rather than show you that formula, I'm going to give you a little pictorial view of how they spend the money. So the way we spend the money, so here's the way to interpret this big picture. All triangles in this picture are in the final partition PN, okay, no matter what their color. Yeah?
How can you control the angle? It's going to wait then.
Wait to the end of the talk, okay, and I'll tell you.
Okay.
This not doesn't have anything to do with this. Spending the money.
You know, the angle
getting small. Well, no, I'll tell you that at the end, okay? So it's controlled. But here, every triangle pairing here is in the final partition. This red triangle is one of the triangles that was marked somewhere along the line. So when getting going from the coarse partition to the final partition, this red triangle is marked. You see that it got further subdivided and so on. And I want to tell you, where does the red triangle spend its money? And here's where it spends its money. It's labeled by green, green for money. American money is green, by the way. The euro is another thing. So here's the way it spends its money. It's going to spend its money on cells closest to it, first of all. It's not going to spend its money way over here. It's going to spend it closest to it. So this guy is going to get no money from the red cell. This guy gets a little bit of money. This guy gets more, this guy gets more. But another important feature, it never spends money on cells that appeared later, that appeared later in the subdivision. It always gives its money to cells that already are there. So it doesn't spend money on smaller cells. This is the formula. You could go back to this formula and see that that's what this is doing. With this formula, you can prove then that every cell that in PN receives in total at least some fraction of a dollar or some B dollar from all the delta combined. That is, you look at its total amount that it got in its coffer. And then with that, you then get this proof of this theorem about control on the number of subdivisions necessary to remove hanging notes. So the next thing I was going to talk about was a coarsening algorithm. I'll spend 1 minute. Fortunately, Peter Binyeff is going to give a talk. Is it today or
today?
And he's going to go into more detail about this coarsening algorithm. But I'll just say two or three words about it. So what we want to do in a coarsening algorithm, the way it's going to work is as follows. We have at a remember we have this partition PKK, and we have the UPKK, which is a Galerkin solution. This is known to us. This we compute. Now you can say, wow, you really don't know UPKK. You only have an approximation. Everything is approximations when you do computation. But anyway, it's known to us. What we want to do in the coarsening algorithm, this may have a lot of triangles in this PKKK. We would like to take this function and approximate it well by a partition with a few triangles. That's how our coarsening is going to work. So this may be large, we want to find a sparse approximation to this. So what we're going to do is generate a newer partition that's contained in PKK, but much smaller, removing some of the refinements. You may think of it like pruning a tree. So you have this master tree. I'm not going to discuss it, but okay, so here, you have this tree associated to PKK. Remember, every partition has a tree. And you could view the coarsening as somehow going here and pruning the tree, removing some subdivisions you did. This is not how we prove it, by the way. This is a good way to mentally think about it. It would be nice if we could actually prove it that way, but we can't. We don't know how yet to prove it that way. So our proof is different. Peter Binyak will tell you it. But this is roughly the idea. You want to go in and prune this tree. Okay, I stop there. I thank you very much, and I ask your question when you want to ask it. Yeah. So Yu Shang is worried about the minimal angle condition. That's where the Lewis vertex bisection helps you, you see. Once you've done this subdivision, if you went ahead and did this subdivision next, yes, you would get small, very small angle. But the fact is, by labeling this as the Lewis vertex, notice that this angle is big, and then you subdivide. Notice this angle is big, and you subdivide. Notice this angle is big, and you subdivide. And what you can prove is that when you do the Lewis vertex subdivision, that the triangles that appear in this fall into equivalency classes. There are certain classes, E1, E2. There are a finite number of equivalency classes that every triangle in here is congruent in the equivalency class. And since there are a finite number of them, they satisfy a minimal angle condition.
Never
subdivide that again. No, if you're going to subdivide it, you do that. See, that's why you use this newest vertex. So it keeps the angles big. This is a very nice scheme, this newest vertex subdivision. Yeah.
What was not known is that the completion takes only a proportionality.
Yeah.
So if I try finally after listening more than once to
understand a gist in what you do, let me see if I can summarize that in two sentences. So if you are trying to do nonlinear approximation, you are trying to resolve a known object. And then you have an algorithm how to approach and find the singular part in the object and resolve them optimally and so on. And your problem, of course, is because you don't know the object. And you cannot spend too much energy in finding the object before you find a strategy how to resolve the object. So you have a step, which I'm arguing all the time, which is less essential, whose critical component is that you don't invest too much in that step, but you get enough information about the structure of your object so that within that iteration you can do optimally the representation of the object. And the coarsening is the algorithm to optimally represent, and anything behind that, before that, is the attempt to find the object at high enough resolution in order to resolve it.
This is exactly how
it works.
So you don't have to hear the next 7 times I give the talk. However, I don't know about the other people. Yeah, that's exactly it. You do some computation to get a certain resolution of the unknown object. Then you go back and you look for an optimal approximation to what you've computed, the UPK, not to the tolerance epsilon that you resolved to, but some coarser tolerance. Okay, constant times epsilon, and then you keep repeating this by changing epsilon to epsilon over 2, epsilon over 4, and so on. Keep reducing epsilon.
So at the very beginning you mentioned that you prove a simple version of something you want to prove. What you prove is there's one tree of partitions, which is a tree of partitions created by this particular refinement.
Yeah.
So, and for this, inside this you prove optimality.
Yeah.
Because your competition is not over all nice partitions, but only the partitions created by this
particular
thing.
Yeah.
So, and you say you are very close to proving for any. So, what is the class of any?
The any would be all n triangles with minimal angle condition, no hanging nodes. And why I tell you we're close to it? Because we can almost characterize the functions that are in this class at AS for Lewis vertex. This turns out to be a Bessel class. And once we have the Bessel class, you can look at the entropy of the Bessel class and see you can't do better than that.
Right. So the comparisons again for this a little bit smooth class of you have a, you know this best N-term approximation with respect to a larger class of triangular partitions.
Yes.
It's characterized. Now you take the decay class, and this is characterized by something which doesn't depend on the way you created those guys.
Right.
And therefore you're saying.
Yeah.
Okay.
No, but what's clear, what notice here.
So it's linear, so higher order method can be.
That's
let me just make one additional point. This putting as a minimal angle condition is perhaps not something that you would want to do. I mean, if you could allow triangles with small angles, you could probably resolve the solution U better, potentially better. For example, in flow problems, you definitely want to have triangles with small angles. The problem is that the finite element analysis doesn't hold when you remove the minimal angle condition. That is, you look at equivalency of norms and estimates at that time, it doesn't hold. So we're looking only at partitions that have a minimal angle condition, so there's some, even though there's grading in the partition, the triangle can't be degenerate.
I think we should stop very quickly, because otherwise we fall too much behind schedule.
What is the advantage of this bisection subdivision over the usual subdivision connected to three points in the entry?
I think we could also prove a theorem like this removal of hanging note. But the theorem to remove hanging note is the deepest analytical part. Is to prove that theorem is the most difficult part, I'd say, in this part.
And you'd have to prove that for this other type of subdivision. I think you could, but you have to prove it.
You have to take it away later, and you lose nothing. Very quickly.
I know that when you look at this problem, you look at a number of computations to offer complexity. But in building a commercial product, for example, it's more important to look at the memory usage, the cache memory. Have you looked
at that? In the numerical simulation, that is very important how quick you get your solution. It's not like encoding. It's not the
other. No, I mean, when you have a tree, then you have to use a lot of cache memory.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, you're right in terms of if you look at a memory allocation. I'm not sure it's an issue in this.
But it's linear.
Well, it's linear, but it's big because you're looking at the whole tree to prune it back to the small tree.
And that's just very expensive. I mean, it's not
storage memory. But notice when Peter gives his talk, his algorithm does not look at the whole tree.
That's my question.
Okay. His algorithm at CoarseLink will start with coarse and work to find. He'll grow a tree, he won't prune a tree. And that's an advantage. Yeah.
Good.
Okay. Good.
We have to stop here. Thank you very much.